and his female. Of fowls also of the air by sevens, and the male and his female. Then we read, Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him, into the ark. Thereafter began the great flood. A rain of 40 days and 40 nights covered the entire earth. As the water subsided, the ark is said to have landed on top of Mount Ararat. Before landing his craft, Noah had sent out birds to search for land, a raven and a dove. The dove finally came back with an olive leaf, giving proof that the land was now above the water. After Noah and his crew had disembarked from the ark, we read, And Noah builded an altar unto the Lord, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake. The myths concerning a great deluge are quite numerous. Fraser devotes over 100 pages to them in his great study of the Old Testament folklore. Here, I have space for only a brief discussion of parallel examples from the ancient mythos. The Chaldean account of the Great Flood, as recorded by Berossus, reads as follows. After the death of Ardates, the 9th king of the Chaldeans, his son Xisuthros reigned 18 sari. In his time happened a great deluge, the history of which is thus described. The deity Cronos appeared to him in a vision and warned him that upon the 15th day of the month Dasius there would be a flood by which mankind would be destroyed. He therefore enjoined him to build a vessel and take with him into it his friends and relations and to convey on board everything necessary to sustain life, together with all the different animals, both birds and quadrupeds, and trust himself fearlessly to the deep. He then obeyed the divine admonition and built a vessel 5 stadia in length and 2 in breadth. Into this he put everything which he had prepared, and last of all conveyed into it his wife, his children, and his friends. After the flood had been upon the earth and was in time abated, Xisuthros sent out birds from the vessel, which, not finding any food nor any place whereupon they might rest their feet, returned to him again. After an interval of some days, he sent them forth a second time, and they now returned with their feet tinged with mud. He made a trial a third time with these birds, but they returned to him no more, from whence he judged that the surface of the earth had appeared above the waters. He therefore made an opening in the vessel, and upon looking out, found that it was stranded upon the side of some mountain, upon which he immediately quitted it with his wife, his daughter, and the pilot. Xisuthros then paid his adoration to the earth, and having constructed an altar, offered sacrifices to the gods. The account just cited not only closely agrees with the Genesis story, but also with that excavated from earlier Assyrian archives by George Smith of the British Museum. When we consider, Smith wrote, the difference between the two countries of Palestine and Babylonia, these variations do not appear greater than we should expect. Thus we should expect beforehand that there would be differences in the narrative, and such we usually find. And we may also notice that the uniform account does not always coincide even with the account of the same events given by Berossus from Chaldean sources. The Babylonian and biblical deluge myths are so similar that they must have been derived from some more ancient common source. In both instances, a god warns a virtuous man of the coming of a flood. The man is instructed to build an ark and take into it people, animals, etc. In both cases, after the flood, birds are sent out 3 times from the ark. The ark in both stories landed on a mountain. After leaving the ark, the survivors offered up a sacrifice to the gods. Xisuthros was the 10th king, and Noah was the 10th patriarch. The 3 sons of Xisuthros were Titan, Zerovinus, and Japetisthes. The 3 sons of Noah were Ham, Shem, and Japheth. The biblical story of the flood has an appendix which has had tragic historical consequences. It was related that in celebrating the end of the flood, Noah imbibed too much of an alcoholic beverage, bringing on a drunken state which caused the patriarch to take off all his clothes and to dance around in a state of nudity. One son, Ham, witnessing this orgy, thought it was funny and laughed at it. This conduct, according to the Bible, called forth a divine curse, Ham was turned black by the good Lord and exiled to Africa, and he and his children were doomed to hew woods and draw water for their more fortunate brothers. This propaganda was used to justify the slave trade and is still regarded as gospel truth by Christian racists. There are several Hindu versions of the myth of a great deluge, the oldest being that published in the Satapatha Brahmana, about the 6th century BC. The following condensed account is taken from an authoritative version. Many ages after the creation of the world, Brahma resolved to destroy it with a deluge on account of the wickedness of the people. There lived at the time a pious man named Satyavrata, and as the Lord of the universe loved this pious man and wished to preserve him from the sea of destruction which was to appear on account of the depravity of the age, he appeared before him in the form of Vishnu, the preserver, and said, "In 7 days from the present time, the world will be plunged in an ocean of death, but in the midst of the destroying waves, a large vessel sent by me for thy use shall stand before thee. Then shalt thou take all medicinal herbs, all the variety of foods, and accompanied by 7 saints, encircled by pairs of all brute animals, thou shalt enter the spacious ark and continue in it, secure from the flood, on an immense ocean, without light, except the light of thy holy companions. When the ship shall be agitated by an impetuous wind, thou shalt fasten it with a large sea serpent on my horn. For I will be near thee in the form of a fish, drawing the vessel with thee and thy attendants." Read as mythology, the various stories of a great deluge have considerable cultural value. But taken as history, they are asinine and absurd. This viewpoint was eloquently expressed by Colonel Robert G. Ingersoll in his inimitable style. We read the pagan sacred books with profit and delight. With myth and fable we are ever charmed, and find a pleasure in the endless repetition of the beautiful, poetic, and absurd. We find in all these records of the past, philosophies and dreams, and efforts stained with tears of great and tender souls who tried to pierce the mystery of life and death, to answer the eternal questions of whence and whither, and vainly sought to make with bits of shattered glass a mirror that would, in very truth, reflect the face and form of nature's perfect self. These myths were born of hopes and fears and tears and smiles, and they were touched and colored by all there is of joy and grief between the rosy dawn of birth and death's sad night. They clothed even the stars with passion and gave to gods the faults and frailties of the sons of men. In them the winds and waves were music, and all the lakes and streams and springs, the mountains, woods, and perfumed dells were haunted by 1,000 fairy forms. They made tawny summer's billowed breast the throne and home of love, filled autumn's arms with sun-kissed grapes and gathered sheaves, and pictured winter as a weak old king who felt, like Lear upon his withered face, Cordelia's tears. These myths, though false, are beautiful, and have for many ages and in countless ways enriched the heart and kindled thought. But if the world were taught that all these things are true, and all inspired of God, and that eternal punishment will be the lot of him who dares deny or doubt, the sweetest myth of all the fable world would lose its beauty and become a scorned and hateful thing to every brave and thoughtful man. Further on in this same work, Colonel Bob illustrated these views by submitting the Bible flood story to the scrutiny of reason. Ingersoll lectured and wrote with great charm, and the following extracts are given in his own words. "We know that there are many animals on this continent not found in the old world. These must have been carried from here to the ark and then brought back afterwards. Were the peccary, armadillo, anteater, sloth, agouti, vampire bat, marmoset, howling and prehensile-tailed monkey, the raccoon and muskrat, carried by the angels from America to Asia? How did they get there? Did the polar bear leave his field of ice and journey toward the tropics? How did he know where the ark was? Did the kangaroo swim or jump from Australia to Asia? Did the giraffe, hippopotamus, antelope, and orangutan journey from Africa in search of the ark? Can absurdities go farther than this? What had these animals to eat while on the journey? What did they eat while on the ark? What did they drink? When the rain came, of course, the rivers ran to the seas, and these seas rose and finally covered the world. The waters of the seas mingled with those of the flood would make all salt. It has been calculated that it required to drown the world about 8 times as much water as was in all the seas. To find how salty the waters of the flood must have been, take 8 quarts of fresh water and add 1 quart from the sea. Such water would create instead of allay thirst. Noah had to take in his ark fresh water for all his beasts, birds, and living things. He had to take the proper food for all. How long was he in the ark? 377 days. Think of the food necessary for the monsters of the antediluvian world. 8 persons did all the work. They attended to the wants of 175,000 birds, 3,616 beasts, 1,300 reptiles, and 2 million insects, saying nothing of the countless animalcule. Well, after they all got in, Noah pulled down the window, God shut the door, and the rain commenced. How long did it rain? 40 days. How deep did the water get? About 5.5 miles. How much did it rain a day? Enough to cover the whole world to a depth of about 742 feet. How many trees can live under miles of water for a year? What became of the soil, mashed, scattered, dissolved, and covered with the debris of a world? How were the tender plants and herbs preserved? How were the animals preserved after leaving the ark? There was no grass except such as had been submerged for a year. There were no animals to be devoured by the carnivorous beasts. What became of the birds that devoured other birds? It must be remembered that the pressure of the water when at the highest point, say 29,000 feet, would have been about 800 tons on each square foot. Such a pressure certainly would have destroyed nearly every vestige of vegetable life, so that when the animals came out of the ark, there was not a mouthful of food in the wide world. How were they supported until the world was again clothed with grass? How were those animals taken care of that subsisted on others? Where did the bees get honey, and the ants seeds? There was not a creeping thing on the whole earth, not a breathing creature beneath the whole heavens, not a living substance. Where did the tenants of the ark get food? There is but one answer if the story is true. The food necessary, not only during the year of the flood, but sufficient for many months afterwards, must have been stored in the ark. There's probably not an animal in the world that will not, in a year, eat and drink 10 times its weight. Noah must have provided food and water for a year while in the ark, and food for at least 6 months after they got on shore. It must have required for a pair of elephants about 150 tons of food and water. A couple of mammoths would have required about twice that amount. Of course, there were other monsters that lived on trees, and in a year would have devoured quite a forest. How would 8 persons have distributed this food, even if the ark had been large enough to hold it? How was the ark kept clean? How did the animals get back to their respective countries? Some had to creep back about 6,000 miles, and they could only go a few feet a day. Some of the creeping things must have started for the ark just as soon as they were made and kept up a steady jog for 1,600 years. Think of a couple of the slowest snails leaving a point opposite the ark and starting for the plains of Shinar, a distance of 12,000 miles. Going at the rate of 1 mile a month, it would take them 1,000 years. How did they get there? Polar bears must have come several thousand miles, and so sudden a change of climate must have been exceedingly trying upon their health. How did they know the way to go? Of course, all the polar bears did not go. Only 2 were required. Who selected these? 2 sloths had to make the journey from South America. These creatures cannot travel to exceed 3 rods a day. Editor's note, 1 rod equals 16.5 feet. At this rate, they would make 1 mile in about 100 days. They must have gone about 6,000 miles to reach the ark. Supposing them to have traveled by a reasonably direct route in order to complete the journey before Noah hauled in the plank, They must have started several years before the world was created. We must also consider that these sloths had to board themselves on the way, and that most of their time had to be taken up getting food and water. It is exceedingly doubtful whether a sloth could travel 6,000 miles and board himself in less than 3,000 years. Volumes might be written upon the infinite absurdity of this most incredible, wicked, and foolish of all the fables contained in the last repository of the impossible called the Bible. To me, it is a matter of amazement that it ever was for a moment believed by any intelligent human being. There are some students of mythology who regard all of the deluge stories as having a common origin, and originally they had nothing to do with water, but were related to the sun, the moon, and the stars. This was the conclusion arrived at by Ingersoll, who said, "I believe, though, that the real origin of all these myths is the same, and that it was originally an effort to account for the sun and moon and stars. The sun and moon were the man and wife, or the god and goddess, and the stars were their children. From a celestial myth, it became a terrestrial one. The air, or ether ocean, became a flood produced by rain, and the sun, moon, and stars became man and woman and children. In the original story, the mountain was the place where, in the far east, the sky was supposed to touch the earth, and it was there that the ship containing the celestial passengers finally rested from its voyage." The astronomical origin of the deluge myths are discussed at length in Gerald Massey, The Natural Genesis, and in George St. Clair, Creation Records, and last but not least, in Godfrey Higgins, Anacalypsis. Orthodox Christians, since they are committed to a belief in the literal truth of the Bible, hold that after the flood, men became even more evil than they were before, so that 4,000 years after the creation of the world, God sent his only begotten Son to suffer and die for the salvation of the human race. This ministry of Jesus, the Christ, was supposed to be a unique event in human history. This opinion is no longer tenable among those who accept reason as the criterion of truth. We know that St. Augustine believed that Christianity antedated the Christian era. We now know that many saviors antedated the Christian era. A book was published in 1875 by Kersey Graves, The World 16 Crucified Saviors, or Christianity Before Christ. Early in the present century, a scholarly Christian clergyman, the Reverend Charles H. Vail, wrote a book with the title The World Saviors. In that work, he gave the names of about 25 pre-Christian, virgin-born savior gods, along with the stories of their lives. There is now an extensive literature on the various savior gods. Most of these books have been written by scholars for scholars. The rest of the essay will be an attempt to popularize this material, so as to make it comprehensible to the intelligent general reader who does not have an extensive knowledge of comparative religion. Chapter 3. The Savior God Cults. Comparative hierologists have discovered records of about 30 Savior God religions. These cults spread over all the world in very remote times, but they show evidence of a common origin. The various Savior gods had the following similar traits. 1. They were born on or near Christmas. 2. Their mothers were virgins. 3. They were born in a cave or stable. 4. They worked for the salvation of humanity. 5. They were called saviors, mediators, healers, etc. 6. They were overcome by evil powers. 7. A descent into hell was made by them. 8. After being slain, they arose from death and ascended to heaven at Easter. 9. They founded religious institutions. 10. They were commemorated by Eucharistic rites. 11. Many of these savior gods were believed to make a second coming to the world. The symbolism of the savior god cults has been well summarized by Arthur Findlay, whom we are pleased to cite. The belief in the return of Christ, which has prevailed throughout the Christian era, is just the descendant of this old belief that the Savior God would return to earth. This return of the Savior was associated by the Babylonians and Egyptians in relation to the sun. They mapped out an imaginary zone in the heavens within which lay the paths of the sun, moon, and principal planets. It was divided into 12 signs, marked by 12 constellations called the zodiac, and there was a ceremony or feast to celebrate the entrance of the sun into each sign. The ancients regarded the various heavenly bodies as visible expressions of divine intelligence, and the 12 constellations were considered to be the sun's bodyguard, this number being given to the Savior God-man as the number of his disciples. The word Christ means the Anointed One. Thus, the Savior God worshippers looked upon their Savior as the Christ, which word has come down to us from the Greek word Christos, meaning the Anointed. A similar word was also used for these saviors, meaning good, excellent, beneficent, and gracious. The word the Greeks used was Krestos, and we find these two words, Christos and Krestos, in use prior to the Christian era. Of all the countries surrounding the Mediterranean in those days, the Jews alone were without a Savior God, and their comfort came from their anticipation of his coming to earth and reigning over them as God-man. This idea was not peculiar to the Jews, as at least 1,500 years before the Hebrews thought of a Messiah, the Egyptians were writing of the coming just ruler who would lead the people on the road to righteousness. The Jews evidently borrowed the belief from Egypt and called this anticipated righteous leader by the name of Messiah, which conveyed to them the same idea as Christos did to the Greeks. He was the expected anointed Jewish king who was to subdue all their enemies, whereas the Christ of the Greeks and the neighboring nations was the anointed victim who had suffered on the altar as a sacrifice for their sins. Of all the numerous savior gods, Findlay, in the same work just cited, The Psychic Stream, discussed at length the following divinities. 1. Bel of Babylonia. 2. Osiris of Egypt. 3. Prometheus of Greece. 4. Mithra of Persia. 5. Krishna of India. I shall avail myself of some of the scholarly results of Arthur Findlay's research, to which will be added valuable data from other sources and authorities. Chapter 4. Bel, the Babylonian Christ. In the British Museum, there is an ancient tablet from Babylon dating back to about 2000 BC. This document is a description of a passion play relating to the god Bel. The same divinity was called Baal among the ancient Hebrews. This dramatic performance consisted often of acts or scenes, which we now briefly summarize. Act 1, Bel is taken prisoner. Among the actors of the drama, the one representing Bel was arrested by soldiers and taken off the stage. Act 2, Bel is tried in the Hall of Justice. Here we have a trial in a courtroom. There was a judge and witnesses who gave testimony for and against the victim, who, though found innocent, was sentenced to death. Act 3, Bel is smitten. Bel was in this scene abused and jeered at by the mob. As the prophet Isaiah later worded it, he is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Act 4, Bel is led away to the mount. The actor representing Bel was taken under guard to a hilltop on which was a sacred grove. Act 5, with Bel are taken two malefactors, one of whom is released. In this scene, two criminals were tried. One was found guilty and the other innocent. The guilty malefactor was sentenced to death, and the innocent one was released. The death of the god was not enacted in the amphitheater. This may be, said Findlay, because it took place on a hill where he was hung on one of the trees in the sacred grove, or crucified or slain on an altar, and so could not be enacted on the stage. By now the theater is empty, and everyone has climbed to the top of the hill to witness the death scene. After the death scene, the people return to the amphitheater. Act 6. After Bel has gone to the mount, the city breaks into tumult. In this scene, a mob appeared on the stage, depicting the tumult resulting from the death of Bel. Act 7. Bell's clothes are carried away. The corpse of Bell returned from the mount, was stripped of its clothing, and prepared for burial. Act 8. Bell goes down into the mount and disappears from life. On the side of the hill near the stage was a tomb into which the body of Bell was interred. Act 9. Weeping women seek Bell at the tomb. This scene has been well explained by Findlay as follows. The beliefs surrounding Bell included the belief that he was seen after death in his etheric body. Quite possibly he was seen first of all by a woman, as women are today, and always have been, more clairvoyant than men. Then comes the final scene, depicting what all this display has been leading up to. Act 10. Bell is brought back to life. A stone had sealed up the tomb of Bell. In this final scene of the drama, the stone was rolled away, and Bell walked out of the tomb in funeral garb. As Findlay has stated, as he emerges from the tomb, the audience rises and shouts in its frenzy till all are hoarse. The great drama has reached its climax. Their god has reappeared to prove to them that death has been conquered and that he has secured for all life in the hereafter. This great religious service has never been forgotten. It was copied by the Greeks and is still performed in memory of Christ. The parallels between the Babylonian and Christian myths are so similar that they have been tabulated by George R. Goodman in an article, Easter, in The Free Thinker, May 14, 1965. Bell is taken prisoner. Jesus is taken prisoner. Bell is tried in the Hall of Justice. Jesus is tried in the Hall of Justice. Bell is smitten. Jesus is scourged. Bell is led away to the mount. Jesus is led away to Golgotha. With Bell are taken two malefactors, one of whom is released. With Jesus, two malefactors are led away. Another, Barabbas, is released. After Bell has gone to the mount, the city breaks out in tumult. At the death of Jesus, the veil of the temple is rent. The dead come from the graves and enter the city. Bell's clothes are carried away. Jesus' robe is divided among the soldiers. Bell goes down into the mount and disappears from life. Jesus, from the grave, goes down into the realm of the dead. A weeping woman seeks Bell at the gate of burial. Mary Magdalene comes weeping to the tomb to seek Jesus. Bell is brought back to life. Jesus rises from the grave alive. This chapter on Bell, the Babylonian Christ, is based on a tablet discovered in the ruins of Babylon by Professor H. Zimmern. The curator of the Babylonian section of the British Museum supplied Arthur Findlay with a translation of this document. This material was discussed by Mr. Findlay in his book, The Psychic Stream, and for further details, the reader is referred to that work. Findlay is an authority on psychical research. He was a founder and, for a while, chairman of the International Institute of Psychical Research, and was also vice president of the Glasgow Society of Psychical Research and the Leicester Society for Psychical Research. Chapter 5. Adonis of Syria and Attis of Phrygia. The worship of Adonis was quite popular among the Semites of Western Asia around 2000 BC, and the Greeks borrowed it from them about the 7th century BC. The actual name of this god was Tammuz, since Adonis, the Semitic Adon, is a title meaning Lord. The Greeks, through error, converted this title of honor into a proper name. The Adonis cult was of pre-Semitic origin, going back to the Sumerians, the earliest civilized peoples of Mesopotamia. This fact has been concisely expressed by Fraser. While Tammuz, or his equivalent Adonis, enjoyed a wide and lasting popularity among peoples of the Semitic stock, there are grounds for thinking that his worship originated with a race of other blood and other speech, the Sumerians, who in the dawn of history inhabited the flat alluvial plain at the head of the Persian Gulf and created the civilization which was afterwards called Babylonia. In southern Babylonia, the Sumerians attained at a very early period to a considerable pitch of civilization, for they tilled the soil, reared cattle, built cities, dug canals, and even invented a system of writing, which their Semitic neighbors in time borrowed from them. Tammuz, or Adonis, was one of the oldest gods of the Sumerian pantheon. In the Babylonian mythology, Adonis is regarded as the youthful consort and lover of Ishtar, the great mother goddess. He was believed to die annually and to descend to the underworld. His divine mistress would then journey to hell to bring him back to earth. During the sojourn of Ishtar in the infernal regions, love was banished from the world, and the reproduction of life came to a halt. The great god Ea found it necessary to send a messenger to Allatu, queen of the infernal regions, demanding the return of Adonis and Ishtar to the upper world, so that the life cycle should continue to operate according to the laws of nature. In more than one Babylonian hymn, Tammuz is likened to plants that rapidly fade away. One such lament reads, "A tamarisk that in the garden has drunk no water, whose crown in the field has brought forth no blossom, a willow that rejoiced not by the watercourse, a willow whose roots were torn up, a herb that in the garden had drunk no water." The death of this deity was annually mourned during the midsummer month of Tammuz by his devotees, who chanted dirges over his effigy to the accompaniment of the music of flutes. The laments were chanted over an effigy of the dead god, which was bathed with water, anointed with oil, and clothed in a crimson robe, while the fumes of incense brought the dead deity back to life. The Greeks later on adopted and adapted this theme to their own mythology. The Greek version was restated by Fraser with characteristic charm. The tragical story and the melancholy rites of Adonis are better known to us from the descriptions of Greek writers than from the fragments of Babylonian literature or the brief reference of the prophet Ezekiel, who saw the women of Jerusalem weeping for Tammuz at the north gate of the temple. Mirrored in the glass of Greek mythology, the Oriental deity appears as a comely youth beloved by Aphrodite. In his infancy, the goddess hid him in a chest, which she gave in charge to Persephone, queen of the netherworld. But when Persephone opened the chest and beheld the beauty of the babe, she refused to give him back to Aphrodite, though the goddess of love went down herself to hell to ransom her dear one from the power of the grave. The dispute between the two goddesses of love and death was settled by Zeus, who decreed that Adonis should abide with Persephone in the underworld for one part of the year, and with Aphrodite in the upper world for another part. At last, the fair youth was killed in hunting by a wild boar, or by the jealous Ares, who turned himself into the likeness of a boar, in order to compass the death of his rival. Bitterly did Aphrodite lament the loved and lost Adonis. The strife between the divine rivals for the possession of Adonis appears to be depicted on an Etruscan mirror. The two goddesses, identified by inscriptions, are stationed on either side of Jupiter, who occupies the seat of judgment and lifts an admonitory finger as he looks sternly towards Persephone. Overcome with grief, the goddess of love buries her face in her mantle, while her pertinacious rival, grasping a branch in one hand, points with the other at a closed coffer, which probably contains the youthful Adonis. In this form of the myth, the contest between Aphrodite and Persephone for the possession of Adonis clearly reflects the struggle between Ishtar and Allatu in the land of the dead, while the decision of Zeus that Adonis is to spend one part of the year underground and another part above ground is merely a Greek version of the annual disappearance and reappearance of Tammuz. The myth of Adonis was localized and his rites solemnly practiced at two cities in Western Asia. These places were Byblos on the Syrian coast and Paphos in Cyprus. Now, both of these cities were seats of the worship of Astarte, or Ishtar, and according to tradition, both were ruled by King Cinyras, the father of Adonis. Byblos was the older of the two cities. It was said to have been founded in the dim and distant past by the great god El, whom the Greeks called Cronus and the Romans Saturn. In early historical times, Byblos was the religious capital of the nation. To the Phoenicians, it was what Jerusalem was to the Jews, and Mecca to the Muslims in later days. The city was built on a hill facing the sea, and was famous for its temple of Astarte. This structure occupied an extensive open court surrounded by cloisters, and entered from below by staircases. It was crowned by a tall, cone-shaped obelisk, the sacred emblem of the goddess. In the shrine, the rites of Adonis were also celebrated. In fact, the whole city was sacred to him, and the river Nahr Ibrahim, which flows into the sea near Byblis, was known in ancient times as the Adonis River. A dynasty of kings, the Cinarads, for many generations ruled over Byblis. The last King Cinyras was deposed and sentenced to death by the Roman general Pompey the Great for excesses of tyranny. A remote ancestor of this last Cinyras was said to have founded a fane of Astarte atop Mount Lebanon. The site of this shrine was perhaps at Aphaka, located at the source of the river Adonis, about halfway between Byblis and Baalbek. The sacred grove of Astarte at Aphaka flourished until the 4th century of the Christian era, when the Roman Emperor Constantine destroyed the sanctuary on account of the orgiastic rites performed there. The Vale of Adonis was picturesque, and it was an imposing site for a great pagan sanctuary. Fraser's description of the Vale of Adonis is one of his finest passages. The site of the temple has been discovered by modern travelers near the miserable village which still bears the name of Aphaka at the head of the wild, romantic, wooded gorge of the Adonis. The hamlet stands among groves of noble walnut trees on the brink of the glen. A little way off, the river rushes from a cavern at the foot of a mighty amphitheater of towering cliffs to plunge in a series of cascades into the awful depths of the glen. The deeper it descends, the ranker and denser grows the vegetation, which, sprouting from the crannies and fissures of the rocks, spreads a green veil over the roaring or murmuring stream in the tremendous chasm below. The temple, of which some massive hewn blocks and a fine column of syenite granite still mark the site, occupied a terrace facing the source of the river and commanding a magnificent prospect. Across the foam and the roar of the waterfalls, you look up to the cavern and away to the top of the sublime precipices above. So lofty is the cliff that the goats which creep along its ledges to browse on the bushes appear like ants to the spectator hundreds of feet below. Seaward, the view is especially impressive when the sun floods the profound gorge with golden light, revealing all the fantastic buttresses and rounded towers of its mountain rampart, and falling softly on the varied green of the woods which clothe its steps. It was here that, according to the legend, Adonis met Aphrodite for the first or the last time, and here his mangled body was buried. A fairer scene could hardly be imagined for a story of tragic love and death. Yet, sequestered as the valley is and must always have been, it is not wholly deserted. A convent or a village may be observed here and there, standing out against the sky on the top of some beetling crag, or clinging to the face of a nearby perpendicular cliff high above the foam and the din of the river. And at evening, the lights that twinkle through the gloom betray the presence of human habitations on slopes which might seem inaccessible to man. In antiquity, the whole of the lovely vale appears to have been dedicated to Adonis, and to this day it is haunted by his memory. For the heights which shut it in are crested at various points by ruined monuments of his worship, some of them overhanging dreadful abysses, down which it turns the head dizzy to look and see the eagles wheeling about their nests far below. Every year, in the belief of his worshippers, Adonis was wounded to death on the mountains, and every year the face of nature itself was dyed with his sacred blood. So, year by year, the Syrian damsels lamented his untimely fate, while the red anemone, his flower, bloomed among the cedars of Lebanon, and the river ran red to the sea, fringing the winding shores of the blue Mediterranean, whenever the wind set inshore, with a sinuous band of crimson. West of Syria, in the Mediterranean Sea, lies the island of Cyprus, only one day's sail from the mainland. On clear summer evenings, observers in Syria may have seen the sun setting beyond the mountains of Cyprus. Phoenician invaders settled in Cyprus at an early date and remained there even after the island had succumbed to the sway of the Greeks. The evidences of coins and inscriptions tell us that Phoenician kings reigned at Citium, even down to the time of Alexander the Great. The Phoenician colonists brought north with them their ancient gods. The Baal of Lebanon was probably Adonis. At Amethyst, the rites of Adonis and Astarte were established. These ceremonies, like those at Byblos, resembled those of the Assyrian cult of Egypt so closely that some people identified the Adonis of Amethyst with Osiris. But the great seat of the worship of Adonis and Aphrodite was at Paphos. The temple at Paphos was of considerable antiquity, having been founded, according to Herodotus, by Phoenician colonists from Ascalon. Astarte or Aphrodite was a type of great mother goddess whose sacred symbol was a white cone or pyramid. At certain seasons, these sacred stones were anointed with olive oil. This custom still survives among peasants at Paphos, who annually anoint the cornerstones of the ruined temple of the Paphian goddess. These Cypriot peasants, though nominally Christians, still worship the old deities. For instance, in certain chapels, these people worship the Mother of Christ under the title Phanagia Aphroditessa. The Easter ceremonies still performed in Greek and Roman Catholic churches in Europe are so similar to ancient rites of the Adonis cult that Sir J.G. Fraser has concluded that these churches actually derived these rites from the ancient worshippers of Adonis. The report by an eyewitness of Good Friday and Easter ceremonies in an Orthodox church is given here. During the whole of Good Friday, a waxen image of the dead Christ is exposed to view in the middle of the Greek churches and is covered with fervent kisses by the thronging crowd, while the whole church rings with melancholy, monotonous dirges. Late in the evening, when it has grown quite dark, this waxen image is carried by the priests into the street on a bier adorned with lemons, roses, jessamine, and other flowers, and there begins a grand procession of the multitude, who move in serried ranks, with slow and solemn step, through the whole town. Every man carries his taper and breaks out into doleful lamentation. At all the houses which the procession passes, there are seated women with censers to fumigate the marching host. Thus the community solemnly buries its Christ as if he had just died. At last the waxen image is again deposited in the church, and the same lugubrious chants echo anew. These lamentations, accompanied by a strict fast, continue till midnight, Saturday. As the clock strikes 12, the bishop appears and announces the glad tidings that Christ is risen, to which the crowd replies, "He is risen indeed." And at once the whole city bursts into an uproar of joy, which finds vent in shrieks and shouts, in endless discharge of carronades and muskets, and the explosion of fireworks of every sort. In the very same hour, people plunge from the extremity of the fast into the enjoyment of the Easter lamb and neat wine. Another such first-hand account was recorded by a Sicilian writer and is descriptive of the Easter ceremony celebrated in Roman Catholic churches in Sicily. A truly moving ceremony is the procession which always takes place in the evening in every commune of Sicily, and further the deposition from the cross. The brotherhoods took part in the procession, and the rear was brought up by a great many boys and girls representing saints, both male and female, in carrying the emblems of Christ's passion. The deposition from the cross was managed by the priests. The coffin with the dead Christ in it was flanked by Jews armed with swords, an object of horror and aversion in the midst of profound pity excited by the sight not only of Christ, but of the Mater Dolorosa, who followed behind him. Sometimes the procession followed the 3 hours of agony and the deposition from the cross. The 3 hours commemorated those which Jesus Christ passed upon the cross. Beginning at the 18th and ending at the 21st hour of Italian time, two priests preached alternately on the Passion. Anciently, the sermons were delivered in the open air on the place called the Calvary. At last, when the 3rd hour was about to strike at the words Emisit Spiritum, Christ died, bowing his head among the sobs and tears of the bystanders. Immediately afterwards in some places, 3 hours afterwards in others, the sacred body was unnailed and deposited in the coffin. In Castronuovo, at the Ave Maria, two priests clad as Jews, representing Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, with their servants in costumes, repaired to the Calvary, preceded by the company of the whites. In Salaperuta, the Calvary is erected in the church. At the announcement of the death, the crucified is made to bow his head by means of machinery, while guns are fired, trumpets sound, and amid the silence of the people impressed by the death of the Redeemer, the strains of a melancholy funeral march are heard. Christ is removed from the cross and deposited in the coffin by three priests. After the procession of the dead Christ, the burial is performed. That is, two priests lay Christ in a fictitious sepulcher, from which, at the Mass of Easter Saturday, the image of the risen Christ issues and is elevated upon the altar by means of machinery. Commenting on this narrative, Fraser concluded that, "When we reflect how often the Church has skillfully contrived to plant the seeds of the new faith on the old stock of paganism, we may surmise that the Easter celebration of the dead and risen Adonis was, as we have reason to believe, also celebrated in Syria at the same season. The type, created by Greek artists, of the sorrowful goddess with her dying lover in her arms, resembles and may have been the model of the Pietà of Christian art, the Virgin with the dead body of her divine son in her lap, of which the most celebrated example is the one by Michelangelo in St. Peter's. That noble group, in which the living sorrow of the mother contrasts so wonderfully with languor of death in the son, is one of the finest compositions in marble. Ancient Greek art has bequeathed to us few works so beautiful, and none so pathetic." Jerome, an early Christian scholar, has transmitted to posterity the fact that at Bethlehem, the traditional birthplace of the Lord, was the seat of a sacred grove dedicated to the worship of Adonis. One of the earliest centers of Orthodox Christianity was at Antioch, and this was another ancient seat of the Adonis cult. The Roman Emperor Julian visited Antioch while the worshippers of Adonis were celebrating one of their festivals. When the ruler approached the city, he was given public prayers and treated as if he were a god. A great multitude cried out that the star of salvation had risen in the east. This was undoubtedly the planet Venus as the morning star. Astarte, the divine consort of Adonis, has been identified with the planet Venus. The phases of Venus were carefully noted by Babylonian astronomers, and the annual festival of Adonis was timed to coincide with the appearance of Venus as the morning or evening star. At Antioch, the appearance of the morning star on the festival day signified the coming of the goddess of love to awaken her deceased consort from his state of death. This being the case, we may surmise that it was Venus as the morning star which led the wise men of the East to Bethlehem, that sacred spot which, according to Jerome, witnessed the lament for Adonis and the weeping of the infant Christ. In an old Akkadian hymn, the mother of Tammuz is addressed as O Virgin Ishtar. She was depicted like the Virgin Mary with her divine child in her arms, and likewise she was hailed as the Queen of Heaven. Williamson, in a scholarly study of religious origins, notes that, according to the Babylonian records, the birth of Tammuz was of miraculous nature. But the most remarkable fact in the whole legend is that he was regarded as both the son and husband of his mother. Though paralleled in the Egyptian and in other religions, this astounding dual relationship is here brought more into view. Can it be that this old Babylonian legend is but an archaic version of the story of the Christian Nativity, God the Son incarnating as Jesus Christ, while he is at the same time but another aspect of God the Father? Adonis was a typical savior god, and again, citing Williamson, his death was commemorated annually with mournful chants as his image lay upon a bed or bier. For 3 days was he bewailed as one dead, but then followed the rejoicing over his resurrection. During the ceremony of the resurrection feast, which took place on the 25th of March, the priest, after having touched the mouths of the mourners with holy oil, murmured, "Trust ye in your Lord, for the pains which he endured have procured your salvation." Then the people answered, "Hail to the dove, the restorer of light." The myths concerning Attis have much in common with those relating to Adonis. Attis was to Phrygia what Adonis was to Syria. He was a young herdsman or shepherd, beloved by Cybele, the mother of the gods, and he was the son of the virgin Nanna. His death was caused either by an encounter with a boar or by self-castration at the foot of a pine tree. The original seat of the Attis cult was at Pessinus in Phrygia, but it became prominent in Rome in 204 BC, when the worship of the Phrygian Great Mother of the Gods was adopted by certain inhabitants of the Eternal City. Rome at that time was at war with Carthage. An invading army led by Hannibal was at the gates of Rome. A prophecy of the Sibylline books asserted that the Punic invaders would be driven out of Italy if the goddess Cybele was brought to Rome. Roman ambassadors went to Phrygia and returned with a sacred black stone, emblem of the divinity of the mother goddess. This fetish was installed in the Temple of Victory on the Palatine Hill. The citizens of Rome received immediate benefits from this transaction, for as Fraser pointed out, it was the middle of April when the goddess arrived, and she went to work at once. For the harvest that year was such as had not been seen for many a long day, and in the very next year, Hannibal and his veterans embarked for Africa. As he looked his last on the coast of Italy, fading behind him in the distance, he could not foresee that Europe, which had repelled the arms, would yet yield to the gods of the Orient. In Rome, the festival of the death of Attis was celebrated yearly from March 22nd to the 25th, and the influence of this cult on Christianity is undeniable, for in Italy, Gaul, and Phrygia, the earliest Christians adopted March 25th as the date of the Passion of Christ. In the Attis festival, a pine tree was felled on the 22nd of March, and an effigy of the god was affixed to it, thus being slain and hanged on a tree. The effigy was then entombed. On March 24th, the Day of Blood, the high priest, impersonating the god, drew blood from his arm as a substitute for a human sacrifice. At night, the priests found the tomb illuminated from within, but empty, since on the third day Attis had arisen from the grave. On the 25th of March, the resurrection was joyfully celebrated with a sacramental meal. Initiates had their sins washed away and were said to be born again. The effects of these rites on Christianity have been well documented. In the words of Weigel, "There can be no doubt that these ceremonies and beliefs deeply colored the interpretation placed by the first Christians upon the historic facts of the crucifixion, burial, and coming again to life of Jesus. And indeed, the merging of the worship of Attis into that of Jesus was effected almost without interruption, for these pagan ceremonies were enacted in a sanctuary on the Vatican Hill, which afterwards was taken over by the Christians, and the Mother Church of St. Peter now stands upon the very spot." The reader who wishes further information on topics discussed in this chapter is referred to Fraser, Adonis, Attis, Osiris. Chapter 6. Mithra the Mediator. Mithra, an ancient Iranian sun god, was born of a virgin on December 25th, Christmas. His first worshippers were shepherds, and he was followed in his travels by 12 companions. The Mithraists observed weekly Sabbath days and celebrated the Eucharist by eating wafers marked with a cross. The two great Mithraic festivals were the birth, Christmas, and the resurrection, Easter. During the Easter rites, the priests placed an image of Mithra in a tomb. Later, the chief priest announced the resurrection of the god by saying, "Be of good cheer, sacred band of initiates. Your god has risen from the dead. His pains and suffering shall be your salvation." Kersey Graves, in The World's 16 Crucified Saviors, says that this god was crucified in Persia in 600 BC, citing Godfrey Higgins to the effect that he was slain upon the cross to make atonement for mankind and to take away the sins of the world. This date of 600 BC cannot be correct, for Mithra was known among the pre-Aryan Indians at a much earlier date. He may have been a man who was elevated to godhood after his death during the dominance of the Dravidians, who preceded the Aryans of the Vedic age. Mithra was the mediator between God and man. He was the great sun god of the Roman world. But originally he was not a personification of the light of the sun, for it seems that he was a sky god originally, and that his identification with the sun came later. Mithraism was the outcome of the blending of Persian dualism and Chaldean stellarism. As to how, when, and where Mithra was evolved from a god of light in general into a sun god in particular we have no certain knowledge. The change perhaps took place in Babylonia, Fraser surmised, where, under the powerful influence of Chaldean theology and astrology, the Iranian deities were assimilated to their nearest Semitic counterparts, the supreme god Ahura Mazda being identified with the sky god Bel, while the goddess Anahita was confused with Ishtar, the goddess of the planet Venus, and Mithra was equated with the sun god Shamash. Mithra was one of the minor gods of the Persians, but as the worship spread to Chaldea, Anatolia, and Armenia, he became a major god. Mithraism became the dominant religion of the ruling classes of Pontus, Cappadocia, and Syria. In the 1st century BC, King Mithridates Eupator of Pontus, a devout worshipper of Mithra, engaged in war with the Roman legions. In this struggle, Mithridates was aided by Cilician pirates, whom it seems were converted to Mithraism by their royal patron. Afterwards, these pirates were conquered by the Romans, and then converted the Roman soldiers to the worship of the unconquered sun. The soldiers carried this new religion to all parts of the Roman Empire, where it was adopted by the civilian population and eventually became the dominant religious cult. As to how all this came about, we turn to some remarks of Fraser, expressed with characteristic charm. Outside the Anatolian tableland, the first to observe the rites of Mithra are said to have been the Cilician pirates. During the civil wars which distracted the attention and absorbed the energies of the Romans in the 1st century of our era, the daring rovers seized the opportunity to issue from the secret creeks and winding rivers of Cilicia and scour the seas, landing from time to time, harrying islands, holding cities to ransom, and carrying off from some of the most famous sanctuaries the wealth which had been accumulated there by the piety of the ages. Gorged with plunder and elated by the impunity which they long enjoyed, the corsairs rose to an extraordinary pitch of audacity and effrontery, marching up the high roads of Italy, plundering villas, and abducting Roman magistrates in their robes of office. While at sea, they displayed pomp and pageantry proportioned to the riches which they had amassed by their successful forays. Their galleys flaunted gilded sails and purple awnings, and glided along to the measured splash of silvered oars, while the sounds of music and revelry wafted across the water told to the trembling inhabitants of the neighboring coasts the riot and debauchery of the buccaneers. At the end of the 1st century BC, Mithraism was indubitably the dominant cult of the Roman Empire. The poet Statius even suggested that the old sun god Apollo might be properly addressed as Mithra, who under the rocks of the Persian cave twists the bull's struggling horns. The poet was here referring to a sculptured scene carved on many Mithraic monuments widely scattered throughout the Roman Empire. The carving showed Mithra in a cave kneeling on the back of a bull, twisting the head of the same with one hand, and driving a knife into the flank of the animal with the other. In commenting on the sentiments expressed by Statius, the scholiast Lactantius Placidus opined that Mithra was the sun, worshipped in caves in Persia, and that the horned bull was a symbol of the horned moon. This idea was suggestive of an eclipse of the sun caused by the moon coming between the earth and the sun. The same commentator also noted that Mithra was sometimes pictured as lion-headed, a circumstance which he thought related to the entrance of the sun into the zodiacal constellation of Leo the Lion. This last speculation was both ingenious and erroneous, for the lion-headed god was certainly not Mithra. Images of a lion-head deity with a serpent twined around his body and grasping a key or two in his hands was the Persian god Zervan Akarnan, infinite time, a personification of time. A sect of the Magi held that the divinity was the creator of all things and the progenitor of both Ormuzd and Ahriman. Among the numerous monuments showing the bull sacrifice in Mithraic art, there are shown two other figures dressed like the god, and like him, wearing peaked Phrygian caps. These associates of the bull-slaying god were Kautes, holding a burning torch upright, and Kautopates, holding a burning torch downward. We may surmise that Kautes was the rising sun, Mithra, the noon sun, and Kautopates, the setting sun. The dual torchbearers might also be regarded as symbolic of the sun at the vernal and autumnal equinoxes, respectively. On some of the monuments, Kautes is shown holding in his hands the head of a bull, or a bull is seen browsing or resting by his side. Kautopates, on the other hand, is displayed with a scorpion either held in his hands or crawling at his feet. 5,000 years ago in ancient Babylonia, the sun entered the zodiacal sign of Taurus, the bull, at the vernal equinox, and passed into Scorpio, the scorpion, at the autumnal equinox. Around 3,000 years later in classical Rome, in an account of the precession of the equinoxes, the sun at the beginning of spring was in Aries, the ram, and in the sign of Libra, the balance, at the start of autumn. In the words of Fraser, "It is tempting to conjecture that the traditional emblems of the constellations, which once marked the beginning of spring and the beginning of autumn, were transmitted from Chaldea to the west and preserved in the symbolism of the mysteries long after they had ceased to correspond with the facts of astronomy." The mysteries of Mithra, like those of many other nations, recruited initiates and educated them through several degrees or grades. In the Mithraic system, there were 7 grades, symbolized as 1, the raven, 2, the griffin, 3, the soldier, 4, the lion, 5, the Persian, 6, the courier of the sun, and 7, the eagle. Mithraism was dominant in the Roman Empire up until the time when Christianity became the state religion in the 4th century. Many of the beliefs and doctrines of the Mithraists were adopted by the Christians, who conquered their rivals by absorbing them. An example of this is given here by Weigel. "The Hebrew Sabbath having been abolished by the Christians, the church made a sacred day of Sunday, partly because it was the day of the resurrection, but largely because it was the weekly festival of the sun. For it was a definite Christian policy to take over the pagan festivals endeared to the people by tradition, and to give them a Christian significance. But as a solar festival, Sunday was the sacred day of Mithra. And it's interesting to notice that since Mithra was addressed as Dominus, Lord, Sunday must have been the Lord's Day long before Christian times. The head of the church was the Papa, or Father, now known as the Pope, who was seated in Rome. The Pope's crown is called a tiara, but a tiara is Persian, and perhaps a Mithraic headdress. The ancient chair preserved in the Vatican and supposed